Hey, thank you very much for that, and welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you coast to coast and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network, and the dulcet tones of Christopher Cross means that it is 9:40 on a Tuesday out here in the West Coast. It's time we check in with our friends from SalesportsTalk.com. And we're waiting on Patty Mangan from SalesportTalk.com, and when we get her, we'll throw her on the air. But we do have our guests. It is United States Coast Guard Warrant Officer Michael Zapawa has joined us. Michael, I'm going to take a guess. You're over there at Coast Guard Island in Alameda?
I'm actually on Yerba Buena Island, right there in the center of the bay.
That's a lot of fun, too. If you think about all the shipping that comes through, that's kind of like the traffic cone in the middle, isn't it?
It sure is.
Have you ever had any, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of times there are some guys that are just dumb and they go the wrong way, or that maybe they try to dock in the wrong portage, but do you ever have any, like, real trouble, like, drug cartels delivering 50 keys of coke type of, you know, Hollywood stuff?
That is not very common here in the Bay Area, luckily, and I can't recall a single incident of that type of thing occurring within my area of responsibility, which goes down to St. Louis Obispo all the way up to the Mendocino County line.
So how much of what you do is behind a desk and how much of it is out on the cutter?
Well, I work search and rescue primarily. So my primary duty is to stand watch in a command center on Yerba Buena Island, which is attached to Treasure Island. Yerba Buena is the rocky part. Treasure Island is the flat part that's man-made. So that's primarily what I do. But in addition to that primary duty, I'm also a search mission coordinator, and that puts me overall responsible for the search mission coordination for all SAR cases that happen within the sector of San Francisco AOR.
So search and rescue, I'm thinking about a lot of, like, people may be capsizing by the Farallons or something. Do you go out in choppers and drop into the water? Is it a lot of perilous stuff like that?
Well, I don't personally do that, although sometimes I have to convince my mother more than once that I'm not jumping out of perfectly good helicopters. What we do with the command center is we talk to people who report those issues to us, and we also develop search plans for those pilots and small boats and Coast Guard cutters when we dispatch them to assist.
And then when you're out on the cutter, you've got, what is it, like a 3-inch gun? What's the big one in the front?
Well, cutter is any a boat in the Coast Guard that is above 65 feet. So we have smaller ones here attached to Sector San Francisco, 87-footers. And then we have the larger national security cutters there at Alameda, which are 427 feet, and those are basically 5-inch guns.
Wow. That's the Legend class? That's kind of like Constellation class frigate, right?
Correct. It is the Legend class.
All right. We do have Patty Mangan with us. Patty, we are on with United States Coast Guard Warrant Officer Michael Zapawa, if you have a question for him.
I do, Michael. Thanks for being on the show. I wanted to find out about, in terms of sneaker waves, a big issue right now, and the big warning yesterday. I hope it went through safely. But what is the chance of surviving? If you're a competent swimmer, could you survive the sneaker wave?
Good morning, Patty, and it's such a privilege to be speaking to both you and your listeners again. So you asked about sneaker waves, but before we get into that exactly, let's get some common vocabulary on this subject. So what exactly is a sneaker wave and what is it not? Sneaker waves are not rogue waves. Sometimes these terms are kind of used interchangeably, but they're not the same thing. Rogue waves are defined as waves that are twice the size of the waves around them. They are very rare, and they're unpredictable. In contrast, while there's no scientifically agreed definition of exactly what a sneaker wave is, I mean, one study that I read, this was a scientific study of the phenomenon, referred to it as sneaker waves, run-up events, and mini tsunamis in the same paragraphs. So while our folks in the science community tend to get their arms wrapped around this phenomenon, I'm going to try to describe it from what I understand it from talking to the National Weather Service. Sneaker waves are just waves that run up much further along the beach than other waves in the same environment. So I'm sure that everyone's, you and your listeners have all been to the beach, beautiful day or not a beautiful day, and sometimes when the ocean is very rough, it's something to see, and people go to the beach, and you're walking along the beach, and you're walking right along the where the waves come up, and then a bigger wave comes, and all of a sudden your feet and maybe all the way up to your knees are wet. That is basically what a sneaker wave is. But these can be very large. So if it can go as much as, you know, 45 to 150 feet further up the beach than what was seen previously, if that makes sense.
I'm interested when the Coast Guard, if you think about, you know, the history, they had the life-saving service and the lighthouse service, and everything kind of got folded into the Coast Guard. But is it not true that for a long, long time that they were under the Department of the Treasury or something, and it wasn't until, like, 9/11 that the DOD came in?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. It's not the DOD, though. It's the Department of Homeland Security. Mm. I first joined the Coast Guard in 1996. We were part of the Department of Transportation. But after 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security was established, and the Coast Guard was folded into that.
Patty?
So you didn't answer my question, Michael.
Pardon me. I wasn't quite finished, Patty. I just kind of put a natural pause in there, and I kind of got distracted. So talking about sneaker waves, Oregon State University, they did a study in 2023 in January. They published it, and they said that sneaker waves are more likely to occur in winter months. They're more likely to occur in parts of the world where the continental shelf is narrow, such as California, Oregon, Washington State, parts of Canada. But this is an international issue. It affects every coastline and encounters long-period swells. From Australia to Chile, British Columbia to Morocco, sneaker waves are basically a global threat. So to answer your question, yes, a lot of people survive sneaker waves because they don't get pulled out to sea. So when you're getting wet, you didn't anticipate getting wet, you just survived a sneaker wave. So they are very common, but it's less common for folks to be pulled out into the ocean. And when those folks are pulled out into the ocean, especially in these colder environments, when we have cold water, I mean, in San Francisco Bay and offshore this morning, I checked the temperature is 56 degrees, and we know for a fact that once a person is in cold water, a lot of bad things start to happen. Cold water immersion is likely a culprit in many drownings that occur in Northern California and points north, cold water environment. Cold water drains body heat up to four times faster than cold air. And when your body is immersed in cold water, cold shock can cause dramatic changes in breathing, heart rate, and blood pressure. And sudden involuntary gasp and rapid breathing, and this alone creates a greater risk for drowning, even when you're a confident swimmer in calm waters. Cold water shock is just absolutely deadly.
By the way, with all those new condos going up on Yerba Buena Island, you can buy one of those and have a short commute, right?
Well, I live in the general vicinity of Yerba Buena Island, so my commute is typically only about 15 minutes in the morning.
So what I'm just curious, let's say a cargo ship comes in from Asia, what are the protocols? I know you pass on the ride and all that, but what are the protocols as far as having the permits, passports, things like that before they can dock in U.S. soil?
That's an interesting question. And so the Coast Guard does regulate the maritime transportation system in the United States. So if you think of it like a highway, and most goods arrive in the United States or leave the United States by ship. So that's a pretty vital artery. So the Coast Guard is truly global. We have folks that are in Singapore right now doing hard work, and they're going to different ports, and they're inspecting vessels there, and they're checking containers in Singapore, in places like China, in places like Bangladesh and Indonesia, and they're checking those containers, putting sealed containers tags on those containers so that we know that they've been already inspected by Coast Guard personnel before they even get close to our shores. But normally, when a ship is coming to the United States, they provide us what's called a notice of arrival. That's usually 96 hours in advance. We will screen those vessels to make sure that they're safe. That includes the crew and that they are of an interest to us because of some type of screening criteria. We could do things like board them at sea, but oftentimes they're allowed to come into the port, and we will do some type of safety inspection if it's warranted for that vessel, or some other type of measures depending on the last time they've been inspected by the U.S. Coast Guard.
Are you allowed to go into international waters, or you got out of your jurisdiction?
Well, we're talking international waters is a term that applies to beyond 3 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have our exclusive economic zone up to 200 nautical miles. So typically we're doing those boardings at the sea buoy if they're at sea. So prior to entering the port of San Francisco and Oakland.
Got time for one more question, Patty?
Okay, so then I just wanted to come back to this riptides. How do the riptides versus the sneaker waves versus the rogue? I guess I want to educate our listeners on what to look out for and what how to avoid these dangerous situations.
Patty, that's an excellent question, because rip currents are truly the more deadly of them. Sneaker waves got we had a lot of sneaker wave events that cost people their lives in 2021. Recorded about 8 people dying nationally from sneaker waves. Quite a few of those in California. But in a typical year, sneaker waves are only responsible for 2 deaths internationally. So that's global. Sneaker waves are dangerous because of the cold water environment, and it's kind of hard to sometimes pin the cause of death on exactly a sneaker wave, but we are very confident about rip currents. Rip currents are definitely deadly, and they do occur with regularity. 86 deaths this year from wave-related events, and that's from January 1st through November 20th. 84 of them were attributed to rip currents of those 89.
All right. There he is, United States Coast Guard Warrant Officer Michael Zappawa, stationed at Yerba Buena Island. Of course, that's the halfway point of the Bay Bridge. Michael, thank you so much for your time. And Patty Mangan from SailSportTalk.com. Go there for more information. Thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.